From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. Since Freddie Gray's death, coverage of the spike in crime in Baltimore has centered on fatal shootings. Today, we look into the power of homicide statistics, what that number captures and fails to tell us about neighborhoods and the people who live in them. Then Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist and Baltimorean Ann Tyler on her latest book, A Spool of Blue Thread. Plus the man, the music, the reggae legend, theater critic J. Wynn Russick tells us about the world premiere musical on Bob Marley, called Marley, playing at Center Stage. And scientists at Johns Hopkins have identified a unique pattern in the brains of soldiers injured by IEDs, improvised explosive devices. We talk with the lead researcher about how the study can help us understand the challenges facing veterans returned from combat. Now, news.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Hope you're having a wonderful Memorial Day. Thanks for tuning in to Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. The surge in crime this spring in Baltimore draws attention to all shootings, and especially fatal shootings. The city's homicide statistic is 40% higher than this time last year. The Western District has seen more homicides so far this year than it did for all of 2014. Murder stats are central to public discussions about safety, policing, violence, and even economic development. So we're revisiting a conversation we had 3 months ago, dissecting how homicide numbers, zealously reported by the media, shape how we think about our neighborhoods, communities, and the people who live in them. We spoke with David Kennedy, director of the Center for Crime Prevention and Control at John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York City. He started the program Ceasefire, which aims to reduce violence in inner cities. And Janetta Churchill joined us in the studio. She's a research associate at the Institute for Urban Research at Morgan State University. I asked Janetta Churchill what her research says about what other trends show up in communities and individual neighborhoods with high homicide numbers.
Often when you're hearing crime statistics, specifically homicide, they're looking at the count for Baltimore City as a whole. But we know that homicide is not evenly distributed across the city. It seems to really be focused in some neighborhoods, and it has a disproportionate impact in certain neighborhoods. In 2013, certain neighborhoods had over 10 homicides in them, and that has a very strong impact on the integrity of a neighborhood. When you look at the cumulative impact of not only the homicides, but other types of crime, poverty, poor housing, low education, unemployment, and unequal access to services, that really takes a toll on the stability of a neighborhood.
Well, are you saying that in your research, the homicide statistics tend to drive some of those other things, or that they coexist with those other?
I would not say that it's causal, but they do coexist. In Baltimore City, we tend to see the same patterns happening over and over, whether it's poverty or unemployment. There are certain parts of the city that have some negative outcomes.
David Kennedy, Baltimore has focused on homicide statistics in particular as crucial to public safety. Should city residents see murder numbers as a barometer for public safety of all city residents?
A community that isn't safe and where people don't feel safe cannot function as a community. So we'd better be counting it and we'd better be tracking it right. But to go back to something Janetta just said, these days across the country, not just in Baltimore, you really don't see high levels of gun violence and that kind of public violent crime except in deeply disadvantaged African American communities. The concentration is just extraordinary. The Baltimore conversation has for a long time been, are we above or below 200? And I understand that, and you need a way to capture this. But the national homicide rate right now in Baltimore, as part of that, is about 4 per 100,000 in the population every year. In certain sorts of neighborhoods like Baltimore's high crime neighborhoods, The young black men in those neighborhoods will experience homicide rates above 500 per 100,000 every year. And if you add non-fatal gun woundings, it'll go up as high as 3,000 per 100,000 every year, which means about 1 in 30 young men are being shot and killed every year. The cumulative impact of that on the community can hardly be described.
But it seems as if you're both talking about that it's a very community-specific impact as opposed to a citywide impact.
So the immediate harm falls on individuals, it spreads to their families, it spreads to their communities, and even though on a population basis the number of people that end up dead every year may seem small statistically, it is not small in the life of the community. And it's really not small in the life of a city like Baltimore. What ripples out from it has essentially no boundaries. We look at these neighborhoods where a few people are at extraordinary risk and we say, these are dangerous communities. People on the outside start saying, these are bad places full of bad people. People don't want to go there. People who live in them feel shunned by the rest of the community. They don't really feel part of the city. Those communities get policed at a very high level and people get stopped and arrested and prosecuted. In Baltimore, driven by the violence, the last time anybody did the special analysis, at any given moment, if you were a black man aged 20 to 30, half of you in the city were under criminal justice supervision. They were in prison, in jail, on parole, or on probation. This is one of the primary drivers of bad racial narratives and racial tension. So there is no way to contain what starts with the violence.
Janetta, what would you add to that?
Not just from a criminology vantage point, but also from a public health model. If you look at homicide as a type of injury, homicide is the leading cause of premature death among black males in Maryland, and specifically in Baltimore. Thousands of years of life are being lost. 1,300 years of life were lost in 2013 because
lives shorter than one could have expected them to be.
Exactly. Because of homicide. And then if you were to focus it more even on homicides caused by firearm, that rate would go up. So the impact is very high when you look at the potential that there was for productive lives in these communities. You are losing not just one or two people, but if you look at the collective impact on the community, you are losing so many potential years of life.
On WIPR, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with Janetta Churchill, Research Associate at the Institute for Urban Research at Morgan State University, and David Kennedy of the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York City. David, let me take a minute and ask you to give us a thumbnail description of ceasefire and what it does.
Ceasefire is in some ways built on the facts on the ground that we've just been talking about. The worst thing that can happen in public safety terms in any community is to have these unconscionably high and sustained levels of really, really serious violence, and then everything else that we've been talking about that flows from it, including some things we haven't talked about, like the fact that it's very hard to get economic development in these places. You have impacts on employment. People are afraid to go to school. It just doesn't stop. The current version of ceasefire in Baltimore began in West Baltimore about a year ago in the Western District. The Western District is persistently one of the most dangerous police zones in the city. And in this most dangerous place, it was a few dozen street groups, gangs, drug crews, and that sort of thing, with well under 1,000 people that were driving the overwhelming preponderance of the violence. The Western District is not dangerous. The Western District has a few dangerous people in it. And what ceasefire does is focus on those groups. It gets law enforcement and social service providers and community people all on the same page. It begins direct communication with those groups, and basically the partnership says, we know who you are, we know what you're doing, we want to keep you alive, we want to keep you out of prison, we'd like to help you, and law enforcement is going to tell you ahead of time of the heightened legal consequences that will come if the violence doesn't stop. The intent is to make it very clear that the social standards in the community are for safety, that there's a way out for people who want a way out, and not to put everybody in jail, but to make it really clear that the violence will from now on be met with special consequences. And the result of that was that what we call group member involved violence, this core gang and drug crew violence, went down 80% in the Western District since we started in about June of last year.
On WYPR's Midday, Baltimore Police Commissioner Anthony Batts told Dan Rodericks that police metrics have been around since the 1920s and 30s, and the yearly count of homicides gets a lot of attention.
Baltimore, we were in the high 300s, and now we're down into the 200s, and we continue to drop. New York is another example. So policing is giving you exactly what you're measuring. You want more efficient policing, we become more efficient. You want to focus on homicide rates, we focus on homicide rates. And I think our metrics have to change because policing is not one-dimensional. It has a lot of different sides. When I walked in the door, what we focused on as a city was just the homicide rate.
David Kennedy, would you agree that the metrics need to change?
Of course they do. I mean, there isn't any one dimension that captures the full richness of any important social issue. In policing, a city that focuses exclusively on homicide can easily miss the much, much larger spectrum of people who survive serious violence and end up in wheelchairs and on walkers and with colostomy bags. It can miss people being afraid, not hurt, but terrified and unwilling to go outside. It can bring the homicide and the violence rate down and do it in a way that so alienates the neighborhood that you have an absolute crisis of legitimacy. Policing is, in fact, getting much, much better at grasping ways to be quite serious about tracking a wide range of things. So the commissioner's absolutely right.
I agree with David that it is a broader picture that needs to be painted than just looking at the homicide rate. In 2013, we saw property crimes go up by 6% and robbery rates go up by 4%.
What was happening to homicides that year?
There was actually an increase in that as well. But there are other types of crimes that are impacting people's quality of life across the city. And it's important to look at the impact that those types of crime are having on the way that we live our lives. If people, as he said, are afraid to come out of their homes, don't want to let their children play outside, they just want to be locked up, that is not a way for Baltimore to be vibrant. We need to be able to be attractive and change that image that we have of people associating the wire with Baltimore City and crime being the only thing that people outside of the city want to associate with Baltimore.
You've given us a lot to think about. I thank you both. David Kennedy is director of the Center for Crime Prevention and Control at John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York City. He started the program Ceasefire here in Baltimore. Janetta Churchill is a research associate at the Institute for Urban Research at Morgan State University. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We would love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. Again, that's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. In February, I spoke with the acclaimed novelist Anne Tyler about her latest novel, A Spool of Blue Thread. Anne was kind enough to invite me to her home in Roland Park, in the same neighborhood in Baltimore in which her book takes place. It chronicles several generations of a family called the Whitshanks, and Anne started by introducing us to the middle generation, Abby and Red.
Well, I think of them as the center of the current Whitshank family. As you say, they're the middle generation. It's a family of building contractors. They've been building houses in Roland Park and Guilford and Homeland for some 60 years or something like that. And Red and Abby are now, as the novel opens, they're middle-aged and they're thinking about their old age. So that's where I begin the story.
And they have four children, and then another one that sort of makes the scene in the middle of the novel. They sort of pick up another one eventually. Tell us a little bit about some of them.
Well, there is, of course, always the difficult child. One child who's just a bit of an outsider and a bit of a puzzle. And I think of the other three as being unlike each other enough so that I hope readers can tell the difference between them. There is the fourth child is a kind of oddly acquired child, so that makes, I think, an interesting story. I'm always fascinated by families that are makeshift, where you put together something, you adopt, you marry into, you know, something like that. So
one of the things I love so much about this book and all of the other novels of yours that I've read is that every character is likable. These are people that you're rooting for. These are people that you want to see happy and you want to see succeed. And in many cases, they do succeed quite nicely and they are, in fact, happy. Is likability or sort of just general pleasantness in a character something that's important to you or something that you think is good grist for a novelist to imagine their lives with?
I suppose it's not essential for every novelist, but it takes me about 2 years to write a book. So I'm going to have to be living with these people for 2 years, and I just don't want to live with someone I dislike. On the other hand, there have been a few people that maybe haven't behaved well in my novels. In fact, the patriarch of this family is not entirely admirable. But I'm okay with that as long as I find some inner reason for their behavior and begin to sympathize with them.
The other interesting part about this book is that it goes backwards, if you will. Towards the end of the book, we hear about things that happened well before, in the generation before, what we've heard about for the first part of the book. Was that intentional, and did that particular decision to structure it that way, did that pose writerly challenges?
It began that way because I wanted to write a book that I never had to finish. I hate finishing books. I hate the turning in of the book, the editing process, the publicity process, everything like that. So I thought, well, I'm getting on in years. I could just write this book that never ends, and I could do that by having many, many generations. And then my concern was, yes, but eventually I'll run out of generations because, you know, I'll be caught up to date. And I thought, well, not if I go backward in time. So I'll begin with the current generation. I'll move back. And I think the earliest date that I actually show in the book is 1926. And then I suddenly realized that before then, I wasn't that interested in the people, you know. So I stopped the book. I had to end it after all.
And turning in the book really is tough. This is, you create these families, and you get to know them, and you get to be fond of them, and then you've got to let them go. You got to send them up to Knopf in New York and hope they do okay. That hasn't gotten any easier for you, has it, in the 20 novels that you've written?
No, it hasn't. And beyond the idea of saying goodbye to them is the idea, in a way, they've been my imaginary playmates for 2 years. And to expose them to outside eyes and have somebody say something cool about them would hurt my feelings. So, you know, again, it's on their behalf. I think, well, I don't want people to misunderstand them or say anything censorious.
Anne Tyler, her new book is called A Spool of Blue Thread on 88.1. You're listening to Marilyn Morning.
I'm Tom Hall. Another great character in this book is the house in which the Whitshanks live, and I think of it almost as a character in the novel. It passes from generation to generation, and it's a focal point. It's a real fundament of this family. Talk about the importance of place, the importance of the physical location of where people live and how they spend their days.
I think I'm very concerned with place in my books because I don't have much of a sense of place. I wasn't raised in one place or one house. So I very consciously anchor my characters in a place.
And do you think that's a reaction? Is that for lack of a better word, a deficit in your life? I mean, do you regret not having, grown up in the same room as a little girl and then as an adult?
I do. I envy Baltimore people who say that, they know their friends from nursery school.
Mm-hmm. The house is located on, am I pronouncing it right, Boughton Road?
Boughton Road.
Is that a real road in Roland Park?
No. Mm-hmm. Boughton was a real person who designed Roland Park.
Right, so he was one of the planners, right? I noticed there was a Boughton Place, but I couldn't find a Boughton Road. So it's a real place, and Roland Park and Homeland and Guilford and this area in North Baltimore is an area that you know well. You've lived in this neck of the woods for a long time. It's a natural instinct to you, I think, to write about this area right around the physical place where you're writing the books rather than to travel too far afield. Why do you think that is?
For one thing, it's a very rich area in terms of texture and, grit. And I'm sort of amused by some of the people who have this very strong sense of the past. And I feel as if sometimes when I'm talking to people, I'm almost on a time machine with them. And then when I think about changing the place, let's say writing about someone in some other town, I just picture this. They'd be in a blank white sheet. They wouldn't have any tapestry around them.
But the tapestry is just something that you know all too well because you're living it every day.
Just raised my children here. I've been here for probably soon going to be 50 years.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about Junior Whitshank in the novel, Junior and Linny May. Junior is the father of Red, who is married to Abby, and they have the four kids. Junior is almost obsessed with this house that is owned by a family named the Brills. Why is the house so important to Junior, and is the importance to Junior, does that at all reflect its importance to you?
Junior is from a background we don't know at all at first, and it's turns out to be a very iffy background. So to him, the house is a sort of symbol of class, quality. He built it himself, so he knows it's well made, and he just wants to fit in. And one of the things that I say in the book, or have him think in the book, is something I've thought myself, which is we are theoretically a country without class, but somehow there's a bit around the edges that seeps in. So he never really feels that he's made it, but he clings to this house, which is the symbol for him, and which he longs to pass down forever to his family.
On 88.1, I'm Tom Hall. We're listening to a conversation I had with Anne Tyler about her latest novel, A Spool of Blue Thread. I was taken with a particular passage in the novel in which Abby remarks that time passes slowly when we're younger and quickly when we're older. And because, if we're lucky, we spend so much more time being older than younger, Abby says, it all evens out. I asked Anne Tyler how that kind of trenchant observation comes to her while she's writing a book.
When I begin writing, it's so mechanical. I have none of those thoughts. I'm just trying to move my characters around on the page. And there's a moment when they begin taking charge, which I do know how airy-fairy that sounds, but most writers say the same thing. The characters take over. So at that point, for instance, Abby might start talking about time and her view of time. And I'm basically sitting back and saying, well, isn't that interesting? I never thought of that, I have been known to laugh aloud in my writing room when one of my characters comes out with a piece of dialogue, and it's not like laughing at my own joke. It's that they were talking, and they said something I never would have thought of. Mm-hmm. So,
Is there a particular aspiration when one reads this novel or your entire opus, do you have a particular aspiration as to what you'd like the reader to understand?
No, I'm not writing for them to get any sort of lesson or understanding. As I say, it begins as such a self-centered process. I'm writing to see what it would feel like to be somebody else. And then when I get it down, I think, so that it feels real to me, then I think I'd like other people to see what it feels like to be that person too. And that's it. I don't care if they take away a moral or a lesson of any sort.
Ann Tyler, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
I enjoyed talking to you. Thank you.
Ann Tyler's 20th novel is called A Spool of Blue Thread. We spoke in her North Baltimore home last February. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for joining us on this Memorial Day edition of Maryland Morning with Sheila Cass. There's lots more after a break. Stick around on 88.1.
Is there an issue in Maryland that you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org. Or you can leave us a voicemail. Just call 410-881-3162. Now, back to the show.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Marley, the new musical with music and lyrics by Bob Marley and the book by Kwame Kwe Arma, the artistic director of Center Stage, has opened at Center Stage, and our theater critic Jay Wynn Russick joins me this morning for this special Memorial Day theater review. How are you doing, Judy?
I'm fine. Happy Memorial Day.
Thank you. So this is a very highly anticipated show. It's the first time that Bob Marley's biography and his music have been put into a stage show, but Kwame has chosen only to concentrate on a few years. So how does that work?
Well, I want to start out by saying, Tom, that this is a really exciting show. It has actors and audience members dancing in the aisles, and it engulfs you in Bob Marley's world and music. But, as you say, it's not a standard birth-to-death musical documentary. What Kwame Kwe Arma, Center Stage's artistic director who wrote and directed Marley, has done is to focus in on a few pivotal representative years in the 1970s. This is when the reggae singer was living in self-imposed exile in London and when he became an international star. And at the same time, his native country, Jamaica, was in all kinds of turmoil that he had been trying to mend. It's a situation that has some really eerie, sad parallels to recent turmoil on the streets in Baltimore. But the time frame also works well in musical theater terms because Kwame starts with a concert that Marley and his band, the Wailers, gave with Stevie Wonder, and he ends the play with a concert, the One Love Peace concert that Marley hoped would reunite his country when he came back. Kwame has really done a huge thing here, theatrically, musically, and in terms of thematic timeliness.
Yeah, and I saw the dress rehearsal the night before it opened in previews a couple of weeks ago, and I understand from Kwame and others that it has changed quite considerably since then. I think when I saw it, there were 20-something songs. I think at one point there might have been, they've added a few, so it's nearly 30 songs or something. So there's a lot of Marley's music in the show. Does he just sort of perform it in, you know, scene after scene, concert scene after concert scene? How's he set it up?
Well, the concerts do provide a great natural setting for the music, but songs are also performed in recording sessions or when Marley is writing them. So it's a very fluid style, very natural presentational format. The main feature of designer Neil Patel's set is a turntable with a giant record painted on it. I only noticed one case when the songs were sung in the style of a traditional book musical. What I mean by that is that It was an instance when two characters spontaneously burst into song to express their heightened feelings. That's an angry second-act duet that's sung by Mitchell Brunings, who plays Bob Marley, and Seikan Sinblah, who does a really powerful job as his wife. I don't want to wait to beg for your love. No man no cry. Cause if summer is here, I'm still waiting there.
That's No Woman, No Cry and Waiting in Vain from Center Stage's new production of Marley. Now, Center Stage held auditions literally all over the world, from London to Jamaica, to find somebody to play Bob Marley. Kwame and I talked about it when he was on the show a few weeks ago. Mitchell Brunings, whom you just mentioned, he's the one that Kwame chose. He won an award on the Dutch equivalent of The Voice, but he's never acted. So what's your take on his acting?
Well, he is someone who achieved international YouTube stardom after singing Marley's redemption song on The Voice of Holland. I think you played that on the air when you interviewed Kwame. Center Stage got him an acting coach. I have to say, if you didn't know that Mitchell Brunings had never acted before, you would not guess it from this show. He has a very strong stage presence. He easily commands the stage. He doesn't look like Marley, even with a wig of dreadlocks. I think his voice is also smoother than Marley's, but he does a really good job conveying Marley's thoughtful nature, the importance of the Rastafari religion in his life, his efforts to bring people together, and not his efforts not to be connected with any one political party or faction. I brought you a sample of him singing Exodus, which Marley sings in response to a reporter's question during an international tour.
Open your eyes and look within. Are you satisfied with the life you're living? We know where we're going.
That's Mitchell Brunings singing Exodus at Center Stage, playing the role of Marley. And I agree. I thought the fact that he acted as well as he did was really a wonderful surprise. I think he's a great stage presence. This is a huge production for Center Stage. Lots of people on in the cast. I didn't take time to count them. But it has some outside producers who have provided enhancement money, as it were. I mean, this is what would have been too much for Center Stage to take on its own. It seems likely that there's some solid interest in having this show have some life after Center Stage. So one of the questions is it ready?
I don't think it's quite ready yet. It's close. There's a lot of electricity on stage. It definitely brings Marley's spirit back to life. It does need some fine-tuning. There's enormous energy built up in the first act, but for me, it dissipates a little in the second act. There's a scene in Ethiopia with a Rasta elder that I think goes on too long, and there's an odd framing device with a young man who has a cell phone and a sketch artist at the very beginning, and the sketch artist shows up at the end, and it's a little extraneous and confusing. I think they could lose that. But there's a lot of power on that stage. I think you'd agree.
And because it's a terrific cast besides Mitchell Brunings, who plays Marley.
Yes.
The wife and the people who play as managers.
Oh, right.
I mean, they're really some great
performances. Absolutely, and some really good musicians. The band is terrific. And the show definitely has the desired impact on the Baltimore audience. And considering the state of unrest in a lot of this country, it's coming at a time when I think audiences are hungry for inspiration and for hope.
All right. Well, we hope that you will be back next Monday, and I bet you will. So thanks very much, Judy Russick.
You can count on it.
There you go. Marley at Center Stage, the new show by Kwame Kwe Arma, starring Mitchell Brunings. We'll have more information about it on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. It's at Center Stage until June 14th. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. Lots more coming up. I'm Tom Hall. Stick around.
Do you have thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wypr.org. Or you can find us on Twitter. We're at Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. In the early 20th century, tens of thousands of British soldiers returned home from World War I battles with a mysterious condition that left them racked with anxiety and in psychological distress. It was thought to be caused by the blast of artillery shells, so people called it shell shock. 100 years later, scientists at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine have found what they believe to be the physical evidence of shell shock in the brains of veterans. I spoke about it in January with Dr. Vasilis Koliatsos, professor of pathology, neurology, and psychiatry at the Hopkins School of Medicine. He looked at the brains of veterans of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan who had died not in battle, but afterwards, after they returned home. And in these autopsies, he saw a pattern of similar lesions. I asked him how he came to the conclusion that these lesions were a result of artillery blasts.
Obviously, this is a difficult question. You look at brains often months and years after the exposure to trauma. I'm talking about physical trauma in this particular case, exposure to explosions. What makes someone link this finding to the blast event, the explosive event, is the pattern. They look different than anything else we've seen before. They look different, for example, from brains that we get from falls or from motor vehicle crashes. This is a new pattern. And when you see a new pattern in science, you really want to pay attention and wonder what this may mean.
So the physical traces you see in the brain are different than what you'd see from somebody who dies in a car crash.
Correct. Correct. So actually, if I could add something here, the only condition that differentiated this group of brains was the exposure to the blast event of their owners. What is interesting here is also that most of these young people died of methadone overdose, perhaps accidental overdose. So you had to look at brains that died of methadone overdose without prior exposure to blast, and They look different. So these brains look different not only compared to motor vehicle crash brains, but also compared with people who died of drug overdoses.
You've described this pattern as a, quote, distinctive honeycomb pattern of broken and swollen nerve fibers. Do we know how and why that pattern is created? What is going on in the brain that makes it?
We don't exactly know. As you said in the beginning, blast is a 100-year-old mystery. We do believe from engineering models where you simulate blast events, we do believe that the physical effect of the blast on the brain produces these squeeze events, if you wish, or other complex mechanical events that create these diffuse lesions, these widespread lesions. They're tiny, they're very small, but they're widespread. And many of them are in the front of the brain, what we call the frontal lobe, which really makes people having difficulties concentrating, putting things together, planning ahead. It makes life difficult for you.
That's Vasilis Koliatsos, professor of pathology, neurology, and psychiatry at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. Here on Maryland Morning 88.1, I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about his research into the impact of IEDs on veterans' brains. So can this study tell us anything about how we may be able to treat the psychological trauma that veterans suffer?
Not directly, but obviously it raises some very important questions. For example, if you see depression or mood changes or changes in personality in someone who's been exposed to blast as part of the combat experience, one wonders, is it just a vanilla depression, like depression you see on everybody, or it is that also life has become very difficult for this person because they cannot put things together. It's a frontal lobe lesion. Life is difficult. You cannot concentrate. You cannot remember very well. You cannot put things together. You cannot plan. You cannot organize your day. If life becomes difficult, you can imagine that it's more easier for you to become depressed. Or if you are depressed, depression is getting worse.
Can you envision that there might be a medicine that would actually fill in that honeycomb pattern and actually
fix things in the brain?
So the implication actually is that you may need to concentrate on the frontal lobe. We don't have exactly medicines that have been proven to be effective, but we do have some medicines to help with frontal lobe functions. For example, the easiest case is stimulants we use for children with attention deficit hyperactivity. So in other words, we might want to concentrate more on frontal lobe functions rather than just concentrate on depression. This is one implication. The other is by finding small lesions in the brain, it takes away some of the stigma associated with mental illness, unfortunately, still in our communities. It takes away the idea that this is some sort of mental weakness. These people may have real brain problems.
Physical
brain lesions. As tiny as they can be, it may make the function of the front of the brain more difficult.
You studied autopsies on the brains of deceased veterans. Could we someday be able to detect these lesions, this unique pattern, while a veteran is still alive?
That would be ideal. And I would hope that these findings would make people more interested in developing strategies to look at these lesions in living brain. Unfortunately, the ways we have to look at brains right now, like the magnetic resonance imaging we have, the MRI, do not have the granularity. They do not have the degree of detail you have with the microscope.
In an autopsy.
But it may be getting there in the next few years with the new improved technologies. And again, my hope would be that one day, perhaps not too far from today, we would be able to study these phenomena, these lesions in the living brain. That would be also the best way to link up such changes to the blast event, because you would be able to follow a human being after the event over time.
This is so interesting. Thank you so much for explaining it to us. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Vasilis Koliatsos is a professor of pathology, neurology, and psychiatry at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. We spoke in January. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Maryland Morning is an original production of Your Public Radio,
WYPR, in Baltimore.
The show is produced by Matt Purdy
and Jonna McCone.
Nathan Sterner directs and engineers.
I'm Tom Hall.
And I'm Sheila Cast. On this day, we honor members of the armed forces who died in service to our country. Maryland lost one soldier in the past 12 months, U.S. Army Sergeant Major Wardell Turner. He was a native of Nanticoke, Maryland, and a graduate of Towson University. He died on November 24, 2014, in Kabul, Afghanistan, a casualty of an improvised explosive device. He was 48 years old.